94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're talking to Andrea Press and Eric Irizarry. Andrea Press is internationally known for her scholarship on the cultural impact of the U.S. media, specifically regarding feminist issues and members of different social classes. We'll talk about her new book. She has many new books. One of them is Media and Class, TV, Film, and Digital Culture, Feminist Reception, Studies in a Post-Audience Age, Media Ready Feminism and Everyday Sexism. Her current research is What is Consent? It's a project that she is into right now. And her classes, we're going to discuss one of them at least, called Sex and Gender, Go to the Movies. We also have here Charlottesville High School principal, Eric Irizarry. We'll talk about gun violence, school safety, and how he navigates his role in the increasingly complex world of high school. You can check out all our podcasts on the 947wpvc.org website. We've got everything from the history of fascism to soul food, Black Panther to comedians, all talented, scholarly, fascinating people, mostly from right here in Charlottesville. You can download one today. Speaking of talented people, Nancy Lawrence, are you there?
I am. You got me. God. And I can't swear. You got me, Ellen. Yes, I am here to answer your question most in the affirmative. Do you think we're doing all of this today? We get extra credit from these two very prolific teachers?
I think so.
Well, actually, principal.
Yeah, they're bringing a lot of class to our show. I just want to say one thing. Let's see if you know where this quote comes from. I could talk to you all day, but don't you have a million things to do?
Yeah, that's from our show, Apropos of Something and Friends, when we had that crazy old man on that yelled at the country
for
30 minutes.
I
remember that show.
Screaming, making the hosts completely uncomfortable.
Yeah, realizing the product they're endorsing perhaps has some flaws. Amidst all that, I did see yesterday that it was done so well that Kellyanne Conway is insisting this is going to be a regular activity, because what you saw was not what you thought you saw. It was actually a stunning, performance.
So they're going to do more?
We're going to get more of it. Huh?
Michael Avenatti is going to love it if they do more.
Exactly. Exactly. They're going to be having the scribe standing by every courthouse updating whatever brief they need to, no matter what.
I mean,
out of our president's mouth.
Among the things he said was he didn't get Melania a present. And he was, some of the clips I heard were sort of the same, but then there was one I saw where he was ranting about the Electoral College still and the popular vote. And then it was like, that uncle that we always talk about. I mean, it was unbelievable.
So, no one thought she'd get to 270 or whatever.
I know. People say I'm the best president. And also, we know, unfortunately, Barbara Bush died, and Melania attended by herself. And I saw this really great tweet in the Washington Post by Simply TC that said, I haven't seen Melania smile this much in years. She's happier with the Obamas at a funeral than she is with her husband in the White House.
Yeah, I know. They have shown a few gifts of the president reaching for his wife's hand while Macron was at the White House, and she's not having it. She just she's not going to make physical contact with that guy, no matter what. It's quite a display.
Blame her. Also, he's trying to stay away from the Justice Department. But at some point he said I won't.
I know.
It's good. It's good for us. Sort of.
Well, yeah. I mean, his mind is just, you can't track it. I mean, what's her name? Carrie from Homeland can't track it. There's not enough yarn and push pins to figure that guy out.
At one point, one of the hosts of Fox and Friends said, I'm not your doctor. And then gave him some advice about not watching CNN. Oh my gosh. Anyway. So speaking of trying to change the political situation, Indivisible needs volunteers at the City Market here in Charlottesville on May 5th. So if you have an hour or two between 7 and noon on that Saturday. There are still people who are not plugged in with Indivisible and don't know about them and the work they're doing, which is a lot. They're organizing, getting out the vote, many things like that. So it is for our outreach on May 5th. You can email them at contact@indivisiblecharlottesville.org.
I have a quick shout-out,
sure,
actually, if I may. The Waffle House hero, James Shaw Jr., who will not be invited, of course, to that White House or even get a phone call. I thought that was just amazing that it was a good guy, a good black guy without a gun, you know, doing this and getting absolutely no recognition from anyone in D.C., but I thought as you probably know, he's raising money, speaking of, a GoFundMe page for all the victims to pay for those four the victims' funerals. It's just
That's amazing.
Amazing story.
Speaking of that, it's traumatic, you know, to see things like that, the whole Starbucks thing, everything that we are able to read about now. So there is a free workshop in Charlottesville called Neuroscience, Yoga, and Mindfulness for helping, you know, with our mental, emotional, physical health. It's free. It's a Common Ground, May 12th, 2 to 4 at the Jefferson School. And that looked like a really cool thing to do, how mindfulness and yoga positively affect your neurophysiology.
Oh, well, I guess I'll... So are we going to have a moment of Zen now?
No, but I just wanted to let people know about that. We have a great show today. Our first guest is Andrea Press. I'm going to turn her microphone on, and I'm going to tell people what I'm doing so that this works. It's the sausage. So Andrea is internationally known. Andrea is internationally known for her scholarship on the cultural impact of the U.S. media, specifically vis-a-vis feminist issues, members of different social classes. She's recognized as a pioneer for her innovative use of qualitative methodology. I mentioned her books before, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. We'll mention her books later, too, where you can buy them. And you can always go to our website and get all the important information that we mentioned will be on 947WBBC.org. So, Andrea, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yes. So let's just start from maybe not the beginning, but your first book, and you've written so much, Women Watching Television. I'm particularly interested in popular culture, gender, class, and generation in the American television experience. So you looked at the cultural impact of TV among women from working and middle class backgrounds. What were the interesting and important findings there?
Well, remember, this is my first book, so when I wrote it, we were still in the age of network television, prime time. So we had what scholars like to think of as more of a mass medium with television. The Cosby Show is very popular. Multitudes of sort of very diverse audiences watching just a few shows available on primetime television. And so what I was looking at were different responses by women who had not been very widely studied at the time. So that was a new type of study to launch, something that focused on the impact of television on women, and also using what we call interpretive methodology. So I actually spoke to people in in-depth interview settings in their homes and spoke pretty widely about their lives and their backgrounds and got them to draw their discussion of television and other media into the context of other issues in their lives. So what I found was that we had kind of an assumption of a middle-class audience in a lot of primetime television shows, and that that contributed to a lack of recognition of themselves by working class women. So they were being encouraged in a way by the shows to identify with the middle class, yet the conditions of their lives were quite different. And honestly, I think it's relevant in some ways to what we're seeing with the discussion of social class in the media today. because we're seeing some outcrying by members of the working class or people who don't really identify with what they see as middle class elites. And they're seeing an absence of address to them in mainstream media. So my recent book that came out this year, Media and Class, Television, Film, and Digital Culture, also addresses these issues more currently. And I do direct people to that book, which is available on Amazon, to look at current discussions of the way media represent social class and the way members of different social classes function as audiences, how they are receiving the way they're addressed and the way they're represented in current media.
So you talk about the qualitative research, or I talked about it, and you do it. Can you give us examples of that, some specifics?
I can. So scholars use that word qualitative to differentiate our research from what we think of as quantitative methods. So a quantitative method would be a survey that you filled out anonymously, say. A qualitative piece of research usually implies that I'm using an interviewing method or a focus group interview. And then I am, rather than sort of aggregating my data with aggregate coding and compiling, I'm interpreting what you actually say.
This is why you're a scientist. But I mean, yeah, examples of what the women were saying in those interviews.
Oh.
Yeah. But that's great, because a lot of people aren't in the academic environment. That's for sure. So
I actually, to bring up a show that's current in the media right now, I had a lot of people talk about The Cosby Show, which was very popular. And what struck me about The Cosby Show was that we had an African-American family with two professional parents, a doctor and a lawyer. So I headed out to my statistical methods of the United States, and I saw that less than 0.1% of the population matched that demographic prototype. So it was a very unusual family demographically. And I was interested in how people responded to that representation of race and class, which was very specific. And so I talked to members of the working class, and they would say things like, you know, I hope that I'll be that affluent one day. I'm working hard, and I hope that will happen. And so people had an image of upward mobility that I thought was unrealistic for a lot of the people I was talking to who were not pursuing higher education. And so we're really sort of not in the running to become Dr. Huxtable and his wife. So it was that kind of thing. And then I would probe the way they spoke about the Huxtables and the way they seemed to identify with that family. And I was really struck by the class divide, that the family was speaking to a really broad swath of people. I'm sorry to bring up Bill Cosby's name so many times today, because it's not a good time to be talking about him, but his show had a dramatic impact on our population in some positive ways, for sure, in terms of its portrayal of race.
Well, what about in terms of the current media landscape, being that there, I mean, I know there is still primetime television, but there are so many other ways to get content out there. So how does that affect the research you do, or just either way, how does it affect the research you do, or what messages women get now?
Well, that's a really broad question. I'll try to answer it. We have a very different media landscape today, obviously. You can't study audiences the way I did when I wrote Women Watching Television, because we have what we call niche audiences. So we have much more targeted media and audiences being much more selective about what they're going to be exposed to. The only place we really still have the mass audience, I would argue, would be in popular Hollywood film. So I still do talk about mass audiences there. But otherwise, audience study looks quite different. We can still use interpretive methods, and we can still talk to audiences about their choice of media and how they respond to media. One of the arguments I'm making in my the book I am writing, Media Ready Feminism and Everyday Sexism, is that in some ways, we still do have an overall portrayal of feminism in popular media. So we have a broad mode of address around some issues still that you can go from medium to medium to medium and actually look at some common characteristics. And I would argue that the portrayal of feminism, there is some kind of broad mode of address that persists in the era of niche audiences. And I think the last election might actually be an unfortunate example of that, where we had a lot of sexist epithets thrown at the female candidate, Hillary Clinton, and they were broadly understood and they were broadly received, not by every member of the audience, and large groups resisted them, but not as many groups as we needed to sway that election. So that is what I'm trying to grapple with, this new media environment in this new book, media about Media Ready Feminism and the way feminism is portrayed in the media in a very specific way that I'm calling Media Ready. I want to say that this book is co-authored with Francesca Tripodi, who is currently a postdoctoral fellow at Data and Society in New York, a UVA graduate with a PhD in sociology, and soon to be assistant professor of sociology at James Madison University.
Can you take apart that or unpack that title, Media Ready Feminism? And
yes. So what we're arguing in this book is that the media portray feminism as kind of a general perspective that most media consider that they're portraying women in a feminist manner. So you see a lot of women with professional, serious jobs, say, in popular Hollywood film, on television shows. You mentioned Carrie's position in Homeland, a show I really love. Interesting portrayal of a working woman in that show. But the kind of feminism that's portrayed is what we're calling media ready. So it is media ready feminism is devoid of its political punch. We don't see feminism as a work in progress generally. And I think feminism really is a work in progress, and the recent Me Too movement, the recent presidential election, all of these issues show us that there's a lot of structural political work yet to be done to achieve gender equality in this society, but the mainstream media don't recognize that with media-ready feminism.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Andrea Press. She's known for her scholarship on the cultural impact of U.S. media. We're going to continue talking with her after this break. Also, we have Eric Irizarry. We'll be talking with him, principal of Charlottesville High School. We will be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday. We have Andrea Press here. We're talking to her about the cultural impact of media. So, Andrea, tell us about, you were alluding and talking about the Me Too movement. Tell us what you have to say about that from the perspective of your work?
Well, I just want to finish up by saying I just was interviewed by a reporter for New York Magazine yesterday about The Handmaid's Tale, which is kind of an interesting new feminist show. And she was expressing some dismay about the sexual violence on the show, which she thinks has been ramped up in season two. And I would agree with that. And season two continues the very feminist writer Margaret Atwood's story. And I think that's an excellent example of media-ready feminism. Here we have an extremely feminist story originated by a writer recognized by second wave feminism, but the way it's being presented to us is by using very cliched forms of violence against women that we've come to be very used to in popular media. We've almost come to expect them. And I think that's a good example of media-ready feminism. Your question about the Me Too movement, I'm excited to speak to that movement. I think this is a very important moment for cultural recognition of sexism. And obviously, it's engaged a wide swath of women from all classes and races. It's important to know that Me Too did not begin with Angelina Jolie and Gwyneth Paltrow, beautiful, white, famous actresses. It began with Tarana Burke, who was an African-American social worker who coined the term to describe the experiences of adolescent women she was working with who happened to be poor minority women who had suffered various types of abuse. But it didn't catch on in the media until famous white actresses took it up and spoke about their experiences, which are much more media ready than the experiences of poor minority women seem to be. Someone asked me the other day, is that because media are wedded to sensationalist depictions? And I think that the experiences of poor minority women are just as sensationalistic as beautiful white or conventionally thought of as beautiful white actresses. But that doesn't kind of capture the bias of media to represent the perspectives of more mainstream famous people who have more resources at their disposal to get their voices heard. That said, I think the Me Too movement is important for all women. It will have an impact on all women's lives, not just those who are wealthy, not just those who are professionals, not just those who are white. And I think it is giving us an opening to talk about structural sexism. We're asking the question. We don't necessarily have the answer as to why harassment is so widespread. Mm-hmm. But at least we're recognizing the existence of widespread harassment. And we're asking the question, why have we accepted it? Why has it been so widespread and such a powerful part of so many women's experiences? And I think this is an important and somewhat unusual media moment. It's an opportunity to pierce media-ready feminism and talk about feminism in a more structural, important way. Potentially activist, potentially transformative way.
Has this administration changed how you see feminism playing a role in our lives or its effect on policy? You know, just
you're talking about the presidential administration.
I am. I was.
Well, you know, Kat the Pollitt last week in The Nation said that Hillary Clinton did more for feminism than anyone in history by losing this election. And I think there's an ironic truth in that because, you know, it was an important loss for feminism, not even speaking to Hillary Clinton per se and her specific qualities or characteristics or whatever objections you might have to the Clintons, which came up a lot in the election, but just focusing on the current administration, the current president's comments about her and his the publicity attendant upon the way he's treated women who have worked for him, the way he's spoken about the beauty contestants in stuff he ran, the way he spoke about his own participation in sexual assault, all of that was widely publicized, widely received by the American public. And I think it all had an impact on us that probably was the cultural antecedent of this Me Too moment. So you know, it has been very important and perhaps ironically will lead to a strengthening of feminist consciousness and feminist perspectives and even legal remedies to structural sexism as we move forward.
I, of course, hope so. It's just that, you know, I can't help but notice, like, when Comey writes a book, when Comey comments on things, when Steve Bannon comments on things, it's those comments are dealt with, but when, you know, like, she still cannot, and maybe it is just a Hillary thing and not a woman thing with Miss Clinton, but she can't do anything right. Like, she shut up, or why haven't you commented? I mean, it's like, and even her daughter, I think she's got a book out too, and she too. I mean, so I hope you're right, you know, and I'm
you know, I think there's no way to actually extricate what is specific to Hillary, to Chelsea, to the Clinton family, and what is a woman thing. And I think we are going to need to move on from the Clintons and figure that out. Obviously, as a professor who studies sexism, I think sexism played a big role in the last election, and I hope we can move forward from that and become more enlightened about the biases in our attitudes, because we have enormous cultural biases against women in power.
So to talk about the media, I think Fox News has a lot to do. They had a lot of time to bash Hillary for many, many years because she's been in the spotlight for so long. Do you think that also contribute? I mean, I think that contributes to,
you know,
the viciousness.
I think it does. And I think the jury's out about whether a different female candidate could have won that election. Personally, I think cultural gender bias played an enormous role in this election. I think we have an overwhelming amount of data to support that conclusion, but there's just no way to factor out the Hillary component.
Mm-hmm.
And she does have a very, very long history.
Yeah. I mean, and that all stemmed from the misogyny Fox News over the years. I just want to go back. We just have a minute left to talk about your latest research. Just talk a little bit about what is consent. And does that at all come into sex positive education? Because we were talking about the toxic masculinity in Handmaid's Tale. And the importance of sex-positive education. But if they don't coincide, I would love to hear about your latest research.
Yes, I've been very fortunate, again, jointly with Francesca Tripodi, to be funded by the University of Virginia Administration and the Power, Violence, Inequality Collective at the University of Virginia to train a group of undergraduates who took our fourth year seminar at University of Virginia and became trained researchers and collected data on the culture of consent on a number of college campuses. And we are currently writing about the way that assault might be aided and abetted. A lot of scholars have been talking about the epidemic of assault on college campuses. We are trying to look at the mechanism by which young women offer consent in sexual, and young men actually, in sexual situations, and who feels free to consent and free to withhold consent, and what it is about the way sexual activity occurs on campuses that discourages the free giving or withholding of consent. So that's what this research is about. And it really pertains, I think it's very relevant to the Me Too movement, because what we're finding is are a number of instances where women did not feel free to withhold consent. Of course, we're finding a lot more than that. We're finding a lot of forcible rape situations as well that women did not feel free to report, or that when they did report them, they did not get much response from police and other authorities. So It all sort of adds up to a world where women are, where violence against women is aided by current structures, structures of sexual activity, structures of workplace structures, workplace hierarchies, and that's what the legal system is going to have to tackle over the next decade, I think.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
Andrea Press.
Yeah.
Her new book is Media and Class, TV, Film, and Digital Culture. Also, Feminist Reception, Studies in a Post-Audience Age. And you also have this book you're working on, Media Ready Feminism and Everyday Sexism, which we touched on. And I would like to mention one more, The Routledge Handbook of Contemporary Feminism.
Yeah. Yes, that should be out next year.
Fantastic.
And the other two books are available on Amazon. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. And we're going to put links to the books on the website, as I mentioned, 947wpvc.org. Hey, Nance, how you doing?
I'm fine. I know we have a news of note that I should note very, very briefly. Mine is about a federal judge who has overruled this administration's racist efforts again and again to end DACA, this time adding that the government has to accept new applications. That came this week, this past week. Judge Bates concluded that the wind-down of DACA was arbitrary and capricious because of the Department of Homeland Security's failing to adequately explain its conclusions that the program was unlawful. The judge also accused the government of providing meager legal reasoning to support its decision. He called the move particularly egregious given the hundreds of thousands of young undocumented immigrants who come here as children protected under the program over its 5 years. And being that these are the times we're living in, of course, I feel compelled to say that this judge is a George W. Bush appointee to the court. His decision was the first to order the program not only to resume accepting new applications. That was what was so amazing about it, considering the Congress continues to sputter and do nothing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks.
Sure.
So just a quickie, the SPLC settled a case. They reached that settlement with the city of Corinth, Mississippi, to shut down its modern-day debtor's prison. The city agreed to stop jailing low-income defendants who can't pay a fine or money or bail for minor offenses, and it goes on. But that's a little bit of good news.
Totally.
So our next guest is Eric Irizarry, and we're going to introduce him. We're going to go to a break, and then we'll come right back and talk to him. He is the Charlottesville High School principal. We're going to talk a lot about gun violence and school safety and how he navigates the very complicated, increasingly complex world of high school in general. We'll be right back with Eric right after this. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something, 947WPVC.org, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. It's me just thinking. I wanted to introduce our next guest, Eric Irizarry. Eric is the principal of Charlottesville High School. He is going to talk about gun violence with us, a topic that we all hear too much about, and school safety. So, Eric, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. So you became principal at Charlottesville High School in July 2016. The election campaign was in full swing.
Mm-hmm.
I hear you created the We Are campaign. Can you tell us why you created it and what that is?
The We Are Charlottesville was really through our athletic department and through our students. We were just able to support the students after the events of August 12th, which, of course, were a traumatic time for Charlottesville, especially our students here. And it was a great event. It was during football season, and it allowed our students to rally behind something, and allowed our staff and our community to rally around what's positive here at Charlottesville High School.
So the tone at your school in before Parkland, how would you describe it? What you're up to there?
Yeah, the tone of the school, you know, we started off with the events of August 12th, which were, that's something that as a school leader, it's very difficult to prepare for. But, we were able to provide some trauma support for our students, some counseling for our students coming back into the building. Our students and staff are very resilient, so they were able to rally around that. So it was a very cohesive year this year. It's and with the events, the tragic events in Parkland really put the light back on school safety and some of the violence that we're seeing across the nation.
And how would you describe the response that the school had after Parkland? What things were set in motion or?
Yeah, I think as school leaders, whether that's from the superintendent on down, our number one priority in the school system is school safety above all. So it's always at the forefront of what we're doing to start the school year. We're always reviewing our safety plans, looking at ways that we can make the school safer, make students feel more supported. So the events, the violent events, Parkland, for example, it hits home, and it really forces you to take a look at the safety measures we have in place and just really taking a look at, what can we be doing better? What supports do the students need? What supports do the staff need? After the event, the first thing we always go to is what do the students need? Because in this day and age, with social media, with the 24-hour news cycle, our students are inundated with these stories, and and sometimes it paints the perceptions that schools aren't safe places. But all the research shows that schools are still the safest places, in the country to be, despite these tragedies. So it's really making sure that the students feel comfortable, they feel like they belong to something larger, whatever that is, and making sure our staff is trained on how to have those difficult conversations moving forward. With the Parkland incident, we saw something that I think most school leaders have not seen on such a level with the national student walkouts, which Charlottesville students participated in both, one in March and the last one last week on April 20th. And that's something that, through social media, students are able to organize a lot quicker and organize nationally. And it was probably one of the most, it was a very proud moment in my career to see our students respectfully, safely organizing, voicing their thoughts, their opinions, especially to elected officials. And we had the walkout event on school campus in March, and students walked off campus along with the other schools in the area on the 20th of April, and our students did a wonderful job. They all brought notes from their parents. They checked out. They met in the parking lot, and they marched down to the downtown mall. So it was inspiring to see our young people, and it just gives you hope that moving forward, that once these students move on into college and the career force, that we're going to be okay.
So you did point to the research that I have heard a lot also, that schools are actually safe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, obviously we have a gun violence problem mm-hmm. in this country where teens are killed. Like in 2016, 3,100 teens were killed or injured by gun violence, and the same number in 2017. I'm sure we're on track for that. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. How do you make the kids, because of the media and all the things that are going on with schools and just gun violence, how do you communicate that they are safe, or and how do you deal with them in a mental health perspective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if I could put it into prongs, we have a three-pronged approach. The first is just making sure the building, the facilities are safe. The doors are locked. It's common sense. You know, folks check in. We have a strong check-in system, making sure we're checking IDs to outside visitors coming in the building. The second part, we are fortunate enough to work with the Charlottesville Police Department, and we have two trained, dedicated school resource officers in the building. And that's an important part in these days, in this day and age, making sure that our school resource officers are trained appropriately. But we have two excellent school resource officers. Officer Nash is not only a school resource officer, he is our school football coach as well. So he really goes above and beyond to make relationships with students, to make sure that they feel safe, that he's a resource in the building for them to talk to, and just really sheds a different light on what police officers do in the community. But the biggest thing we can do as a school to make sure that we're safe is really working on our school culture and climate, making sure students feel welcomed, making sure they feel that they're listened to. We started last year and this year off with teaching our teachers from a trauma-informed standpoint. So making sure that teachers can identify students that are experiencing trauma, whether that's at home, whether that's at school, focusing on restorative practices, making sure students have those social skills to not only tell an adult when they're having difficulties, but also try to work it out with their peers. And that goes along with a lot of our bystander training that we'll be bringing in next year. So it's really taking a look at the whole child and making sure not only do they feel supported in the school building, but when they leave the school building, they also have the skills to resolve their conflicts and to make good choices.
Did you get any, I don't know, pushback or involvement from parents or administration people after Parkland to do things differently or just to have more discussions about the incident?
Yeah, there was a few. Anytime we have events like that, you will get some emails or phone calls on, you know, why don't we have metal detectors, things like that. We're fortunate enough here in the Charlottesville community to know that, you know, schools don't need to be, you know, prisons, for lack of a better term, that, you know, need to be safe places where kids want to be, where they feel welcome. So what we did, our approach was to have a few safety forums. We had safety forums with our stakeholders, parents, mental health providers, law enforcement. But I think the most important thing is I just had voluntary school forums with our students, just to sit around the lunch table and talk to the students and get their opinion. A lot of times as adults, we forget, you know, we make decisions for students, but they have the most important voice, and sometimes they're not as jaded as we are, and they actually have some of the better ideas moving forward. So it was a chance to connect with the students, let them know what procedures and processes we have in place currently, letting them know that, you know, if they feel unsafe in certain areas, or if they feel that there's something more we could do, to listen to them and to see what we can do to make them feel safe.
That's a good point that students, that young people actually are pretty smart, mm-hmm. As we've seen with this very topic, with the movement to stop gun violence. So that's a great point. And I wanted to point out that you are an esteemed doctor yourself. What is your background, and what have you been doing? What led up to this career of yours?
Oh, yeah, I started off as an elementary school teacher in Wilmington, North Carolina. What really got me into the school admin field was I just noticed there were, off the bat, huge achievement gaps between our some of my low-income students and some of our other students. Really motivated me to go back into college, and ended up going to UNCW to pursue my master's in school administration. And graduated grad school at the worst possible time, right at the height of the recession, and ended up getting a job as an assistant principal at a charter school, actually in a rural part of North Carolina, for a few years, and was able to build my background on instructional knowledge and reading literacy, and then came back to Wilmington, North Carolina, to open a school in our downtown community, and it was great to be back home. And from there, we that started my career, is really trying to figure out how, you know, as school leaders, how can we continue to make a difference with our teachers, providing them with the resources, but also, you know, this day and age with technology, with social media, it's really it's been a challenge in a good way to prepare our students for college and career readiness, going from middle school in Wilmington. And I've been here for 2 years and fortunate enough to be in one of the best high schools in Virginia. So it's been a great journey so far.
You also make a point of reminding students that they're part of the bigger picture, that it's not, you know, their life is beyond the school itself. And I was just wondering what sorts of programs do you have for that? Do you encourage students to, you know, see their life in a bigger picture way?
Yeah, one of the benefits at Charlottesville High School is we have a lot of community resources in our building, whether that's additional counseling through Region 10, or whether that's our school-based counselors or mental health providers. Our school counselors are really making sure that when they come in to Charlottesville High School the ninth grade year, that they are thinking about college and career readiness and what that track looks like. In our civics and history classes, they are learning about what is free speech, what's respectful free speech, and, you know, how have students in history, you know, made a difference, and what are their rights. And so it's really a, you know, it's a community approach to making sure students are well-rounded, both academically, through the arts. We have an incredible arts program as well. So letting students follow their passions, guiding them along the way, and making sure that they have a support system around them as they progress through high school.
And what about, like, the alternate education? I know there are some ways you address education outside of a classroom itself.
Yeah, we have multiple programs. One of our most successful programs is our walk program, and that's run by Diana Poe inside of our in our high school, and it just provides students the opportunity to have an alternative approach to education, whether that's a blended model or an online model. It allows students that maybe come to Charlottesville High School credit deficient, that need to catch up in order to graduate. It allows them to work at their own pace in a small environment. And the great thing about the walk program is when you walk in there, they're their own little community inside our larger community. It's a great place to go into. Students are constantly cycling in and out of that classroom in that area, depending on what their schedule is. They have a little tea cart and a snack cart set up for them, and it's a place where students can go, feel welcome, and feel that they're, you know, that they are catching up and that they have a support system in the walk program. And another program is our Lugo McGinnis program, Lugo McGinnis Academy. Stephanie Carter is the principal over there, and it's an alternative school, but it's an alternative way, it's an alternative approach to education. So students over there are allowed to, again, move at their own pace through a blended and online model. And most of the students over there are also attending classes at PVCC or K-Tech. And it's just trying to individualize our approach to education and meet the needs of the students. And those needs are varied.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Do you want to ask one more?
I did. I was just curious, Dr. Irizarry, if the gun violence issue has activated or motivated students to get more involved at the city or state level that you've noticed.
Oh, they have. When you see 400, 400 students organizing outside on our grounds, or 300 students, you know, marching to let their officials know. We had a Get Out the Vote campaign this week, and that was led by our students. So we're just seeing our students becoming more active, using their social media platforms and getting their voice out there.
That's fantastic. I'm glad that you got to say that. Thank you so much again, Dr. Eric Irizarry,
for
being here. Thanks for providing guidance, support for students, for looking at alternate ways, you know, to help people learn, help them learn, and creative approaches to every just about everything that you're doing there. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
I know. He's taking the... making it the idea of going back to high school not such the stigma, the joke. I mean, it doesn't seem to apply to that place.
Hey, I met you there, Nancy. So that's a good thing.
That is true. That is true. It all
circles back. I wanted to mention next week we have the wonderful Tish Jennings with us, the authority on mindfulness for teachers and students, speaking of the learning environment. And we're going to hear about her visit with the Dalai Lama in India last month. And we have Francesca Calamita, who studies food and body issues and women's rights here and in Italy. So looking forward to that.
Totally. Let's just sit right here. Let's keep the radio on until they appear.
Okay.
Talk about it. Okay. Or do that.
We've got the palate cleanser. So I'm going to start. I was in Raleigh, North Carolina. Raleigh, North Carolina this month. And I saw the first genetically modified pet in the U.S., a fluorescent fish called the glowfish. And it sounds weird, but they were originally bred for a good reason more than 10 years ago to help detect environmental pollutants using fluorescent protein that is naturally occurring in marine organisms. And they determined, so this is the cool thing, there's a switch on the fish.
Oh, it's already cool.
It's cool.
So
the scientists develop a switch so that the fish would selectively fluoresce in the presence of environmental toxins. So if the fish wasn't lighting up, it would signal that the water was safe, and the other opposite was true. Isn't that super cool?
That is very cool and much needed, thanks to one Mr. Pruitt. Sorry.
Right.
But no, that's very cool. I will segue in. I'll stay in nature. Yesterday, I'm sure you're aware, even in North Carolina, was National Arbor Day, Ellen.
Oh, fantastic.
The last Friday in April. And it started in 1872 with a journalist, Julius Sterling Morton, in Nebraska City, Nebraska, of all places. They planted a million trees way back when. And by the 1920s, it became a national holiday, and officially in 1970, thanks to Mr. Nixon and the EPA, which goes back to
the environment.
Mr. Pruitt.
So,
but this may be the last year we plant a tree.
I'm just saying. So
okay.
I need to mention our theme music, which is so fun, is by Springtide out of Japan. And I wanted to say to remember everybody listening, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. And my latest hashtag I like to throw about, maybe not too much, but is one more thing. Like, just do one more thing than you're doing, if you can bear it, because I know it's hard, just to get this administration out of there. Thanks, Nance. Any last words?
See you in high school.
Okay.
Let's go back.
Let's go back. Okay, thanks, Nance.
Yep, thanks, Al.